Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm currently on a book tour around the United States and hope to see you. Find the schedule of my events at warisalie.org. It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Dr. Gregory Shupak. He has a PhD in literary studies and teaches media studies at the University of Guelph in Toronto. He is an activist and a fiction writer, and his political analysis, which we'll be talking about, appears regularly in Jacobin, Middle East Eye, and elsewhere. Greg Shupak, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I read a couple of articles that I want to bring up by you recently. One is called The Case Against Bombing ISIS, and the other is called Abolish the Military. Let's start with the first one and see where it goes and hopefully
sure.
Get to the second. What is the case against bombing ISIS?
I guess to put it in the most concise terms possible, I would describe it as the following, that the U.S.-led campaign against ISIS, the military campaign against ISIS, is or has already resulted in a fairly large number of civilian casualties, just over 1,000 at minimum, last time I checked. And I think that considering that this war doesn't in any way address the underlying causes that gave rise to ISIS and is in fact a further enactment of some of the very causes that did lead to the rise of ISIS, I think that those civilian deaths are likely to be in vain, and that even if this particular configuration that we call ISIS is defeated in some sense, that's not going to actually bring any kind of peace and security to the people living in the region, but perhaps empower another similar group or create conditions under which a comparable group that we haven't heard of yet comes into existence.
These civilian casualty figures, I mean, these are sort of what's called passive reporting, right? I mean, this is what turns up in the news, where when scientific studies have gone and been done door to door and so forth afterwards, as in Iraq, the casualties end up being much higher than anybody thought. What do we really know so far in terms of civilian deaths in the campaign against ISIS?
Yeah, I mean, exactly as you say, it is a very conservative method of arriving at these totals. So the most recent, to be more precise, figure that I see as of right now, according to airwars.org, which is a very useful organization for reporting on civilian casualties in this conflict, the most up-to-date number they have is 1,057 minimum civilians likely killed in Iraq and Syria by the U.S.-led coalition. But the threshold that they have for arriving at that number is pretty rigorous. They are going on, they're arriving at that figure based on casualties that they can confirm through, as you say, external reports or media reports. As we've seen in Iraq, that type of research leads to much lower casualty figures than when one saw the type of research done by The Lancet, which carried out the types of methods that I think you were describing that paint a much more dire picture when these kind of aggregate models are put into place and you end up arriving at calculations where there's over 1 million dead or many, many hundreds of thousands of civilians dead in Iraq. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to conclude that this figure of just over 1,000 that I refer to is actually a lot lower than is the reality. And in fact, the Air Wars website will always also note what the reported or claimed number of civilians are. So in other words, civilian casualties that they cannot verify, and those are upward of around 3,000 last I saw. So, I mean, I think it's perfectly plausible that something closer to that is what the total is at this stage. But as you suggest, once on the ground, systematic research is carried out, it's, I think, no stretch to imagine that we could be looking at much, much higher totals once we take into account not just bombing, but also things like the lives lost due to infrastructure damage, due to people fleeing the bombing, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. People are literally starving to death, and all of this these resources are going into bombing rather than getting them food. The other thing is this word, civilian. I mean, we're distinguishing the civilian deaths from the non-civilian deaths, presumably because the non-civilian deaths are a good in themselves, which some of us might not agree with, or they serve some greater purpose. but if we're going to make the case that this is not serving some greater purpose, then maybe we have to consider all deaths to be a downside to the operation. I mean, is it in vain, as you say, that they're going to continue trying to destroy ISIS, or is it actually counterproductive? Is it actually something that ISIS desires?
I think it's both. I think it's in vain and counterproductive. I think those are sort of two consequences that are fused, in the sense that we can't in any way rationalize the deaths of civilians. And as you say, I think there's a good case to be made about to think critically about what civilians actually means when we distinguish it from fighters in this type of context. But I think that there's definitely benefits for ISIS from having this type of campaign enacted. It forces, for one thing, makes people more dependent upon them in the territories that they control, and it adds to their prestige, in a sense, to say, okay, well, you know, ISIS is fighting the Western forces that have wrought such devastation in the region, and look, now here they are doing it again. I think it's something that will, at least in certain quarters, add to ISIS's prestige.
Yeah, I the weirdest thing about ISIS, as numerous past examples of such groups, is that it is presented to the U.S. public as having come out of nowhere in 2014. Where do you think ISIS came from?
I think that there's a pretty strong record of evidence that it has come out of a combination of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I talk about this at some length in my Jacobin article, The Case Against Bombing ISIS. So you have people like Lydia Wilson, an Oxford researcher who has interviewed imprisoned ISIS fighters, and her conclusions are that there's a very, very direct link between the U.S. invasion and destruction and occupation of Iraq and the rise of ISIS. She's far from the only one. She quotes Douglas Stone, a U.S. general who oversaw Iraqi detainees in Iraq during the U.S. occupation, and he says that, quote, every single detainee, end quote, that he encountered in the prison complained about the disintegration of security brought on by the American invasion. I could go on listing similar types of observations, but to speak to your other question, to speak to the other half of the question, Syria, we see a different scenario, but nevertheless a key role played by the United States in terms of laying the groundwork for ISIS. So the U.S. government has had a long-standing desire to replace the Syrian government with someone more reliable in this, or someone more pliable, you might say. It's true that there have been times when the Syrian government has worked with the U.S. government to, you know, render U.S. detainees and so on, or in the 1991 Gulf War. Nevertheless, if you look at something like the WikiLeaks documents on Syria, it's quite clear that the Bush administration had a very strong desire to overthrow the Syrian government, and that the Obama administration, despite a bit of a change in rhetoric, never really abandoned the regime change strategy in Syria. And since the, well, actually, I was going to say since the outbreak of war in Syria, but it actually predates that when the WikiLeaks documents suggest there was an effort to foster sectarian discontent in Syria by the U.S. government. Once that actually came to manifest itself, I suppose, in the Syrian war, the U.S. and particularly its allies, Turkey probably the most, but also Qatar, Saudi Arabia, played Jordan as well, played a major role in fostering the sectarian Sunni-led Takfiri forces, many of which found expression in ISIS or in very similar groups, whether that's Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda formation in Syria, or the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, I should say. And more generally, arming all kinds of Syrian opposition groups, and just as importantly, perhaps more importantly, undermining efforts for a negotiated settlement in Syria, I think creates the types of conditions that are ideal for ISIS, which is horrendous warfare and societal collapse.
Yeah, we're speaking with Gregory Shupak about his articles in Jacobin, including the case against bombing ISIS. It seems like, obviously, Syria is a very complex situation and has included numerous forces, including legitimate grievances against the government by the people of Syria. But what I think is most interesting here, and I think you agree in your article, and you cite a U.S. government report from 2012 that the United States has not been just arming al-Qaeda without knowing it or trying to overthrow the government with some sort of plan for what comes next, but has, you know, knowingly expected that it would create disaster and the sort of forces that you see in ISIS, and has continued down this path anyway. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So what you're referring to is the Defense Intelligence Agency report from 2012, which can be, you know, aspects of it can be interpreted in different ways, but nevertheless, it remains true that the document does say the West, Turkey, and the Gulf states supported the Syrian opposition and admits that the Syrian war could result in the creation of a Salafist principality in eastern Syria, and notes, and I quote, that this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime. And, you know, we had comments from U.S. General Martin Dempsey telling the Senate Armed Services Committee in 2014 that America's Arab allies, as he put it, were funding ISIS, and Joe Biden said the same also in 2014, though he quickly tried to walk that back. So, I mean, it's certainly the case that, yes, I'm not suggesting that the entire opposition to the Syrian government is some U.S. government plot. What I am suggesting is that the U.S. role in Syria has made life much worse for Syrians and has needlessly prolonged the war and empowered some of the worst elements of the Syrian opposition. So, you know, as much as one would like Syrians to have a better government than they currently do, the point to keep in mind here is that the United States policy is not in any way geared towards giving Syrians a more democratic future or some human rights respecting government. It's rather an effort to replace the current government of Syria with somebody amenable to the United States, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. And if you look at all of those governments, you can see that human rights and democracy are not overriding concerns of theirs.
To say the least. It seems like the U.S. public is often given by the media a sort of cartoonish idea of overthrowing governments or overthrowing terrorist organizations / governments like ISIS, with this idea that if certain leaders were murdered and the organization was shut down, all would be well. It doesn't take into account poverty and resentment and violence and grievances and armaments and underlying factors. And I think you make a couple of good points in your article that if somehow ISIS ceased to exist, a new organization with a different name would take its place, or ISIS would move its operations to Libya or Yemen, where the United States is facilitating the growth of similar organizations. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Libya is a particularly useful case for if we're thinking about Syria in the sense that So the U.S. very directly carried out a full scale. Well, the U.S. and its allies in NATO and in the Gulf carried out a full blown military intervention in Libya. And so the dictator's overthrown in Libya. Well, look what has resulted since. I mean, a complete collapse of the society, total wanton violence, and complete political instability, with a lot of factions in power that have carried out some pretty ugly violence, such as the ethnic cleansing of the Tuerga, for example, one of the black African communities in Libya. As you're suggesting, it's not as though we can just say, replace Gaddafi, replace Saddam Hussein, replace Bashar al-Assad, and somehow this solves all of the problems in those societies. I would also add that one reason that doesn't happen is that, the U.S.'s foreign policy goals are not to actually bring, democracy, human rights, prosperity, and security to any of these countries. It's rather to dominate them. And that's by its... That set of goals, which I try to explain and offer evidence for in the Case Against Bombing ISIS article, I think is a pretty clear reason as to why we can't expect democracy and human rights respecting governments in countries where the U.S. carries out a regime change. We can't expect democracy and human rights to emerge because that's not what the U.S. is trying to install anyway. So why would the outcome resemble that when that's not even the goal.
Yeah, I think you do make a good case in the article that the goal is global domination with perhaps a side associated goal of profiteering. And you look at the arms trade, which, you know, I think a lot of people in the United States have no idea that the majority of weapons sold to the Middle East are from the United States. That goal of profiteering off the arms trade almost seems to conflict at times with the goal of domination, in that the U.S. finds itself up against U.S. weapons. How big a factor in Middle East violence is the arming of people in the Middle East by U.S. weapons companies?
Yeah, it's a major factor, you know, you don't have to necessarily even dig very deep to find this. So the New York Times had a report last April, I believe it was, that I think right in the headline went so far as to say that U.S. arms are directly responsible for fueling war in the region. I think that the business of war in America is massive, and not just America, but in its allied states like Britain and Canada. I think that one can't necessarily assume that the U.S. goal is necessarily to create stable societies in the Middle East, in part because so much of the American elite depends upon the sales of weapons, and not just weapons, but all of the other supporting infrastructure along with that. Can one even conceive of a scenario? I can't, where the United States says, "Okay, well, we recognize that." As the New York Times says, our pouring of weapons into the Middle East is fueling proxy wars and sectarian conflict. So therefore, let's stop doing that. That may be a logical conclusion to draw, but when you have company after company making billions upon billions for each of those wars, and these companies are extremely well connected in Washington, does anybody believe, I don't, that this is going to, you know, stop, right? I mean, it's not like the people in power in America don't know what's going on, right? They're not just bumbling along. If the New York Times can point it out, and if I can point it out, then, you know, frankly, intelligent people who are running the Pentagon, who are in the elite business class, are well aware of what's going on. They may not be nice or morally sound people, but they're not morons. Just to make one sort of quick point about how this works, and I mean, there's all kinds of cases that I explore in the article as far as what particular companies made off of were able to make in Iraq war profiteering. But and also in more recent contracts that were issued for fighting ISIS, to see how this works, I'll just point to one example, which, according to a Daily Beast report, a company called AM General is supplying the Iraqi government, the U.S. allied Iraqi government, with 160 U.S. built Humvees. General Dynamic is also selling the country millions of dollars worth of tank ammunition. And another company named SOS International has been awarded $400 million to provide services such as private security, again, in Iraq now, in the context of fighting ISIS. Well, this SOS International, its board of advisors include Paul Wolfowitz and Paul Butler, a former special assistant to Donald Rumsfeld. Paul Wolfowitz was Undersecretary of Defense under Rumsfeld in the Bush administration, for anybody who doesn't know that. So, I mean, t- to me, this illustrates the bipartisan imperialist consensus in American politics that we have these hard right, these neoconservative right-wing figures associated with Rumsfeld, and in fact part of his defense department, and they're now working at companies profiting very directly off of a war being carried out by a Democratic administration.
Yeah, a number of them are working at universities spreading the ideology that supports this sort of institution. And I think the solution is going to come from, you know, canceling the profiteering. But that's not going to happen until we build a movement around the title of your other article that we've left very little time for, but I highly recommend people read, called Abolish the Military, where you look at a number of the negative impacts of militarism, including environmental and humanitarian, and including in particular, I think, what you start with, which is less discussed, I think, by many opponents of war, and that is how militarism abroad fuels racism and sexism in the United States. Can you explain that briefly?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's at even I think the most superficial level, it's relatively obvious that look at the countries that the American military has attacked since World War II. So whether we're talking about Korea, Indochina, Afghanistan, Iraq, all of these countries are populated. You could add Libya as well. All of these countries are populated by people of color, and in every war, a sort of new lexicon gains traction at home, which creates or contributes to racism against people from people in America from the communities that are or originating from the countries being attacked overseas, or not even necessarily originating from or descending from them, but just maybe vaguely looking like they might have ancestry in, you know, the Middle East or in Southeast Asia or wherever. That's one angle, one aspect of the connection between U.S. imperialism and racism. There's also the fact that there's a major problem with neo-Nazism and white supremacy within the U.S. military, and some of the pieces I link to explore that in more detail.
We will have to bring you back for another show to go into that topic. I'm afraid we could go for hours, but we're out of time. I'll have the link up at talknationradio.org to both of these articles. Gregory Shupak, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson.
I'm traveling around the United States right now doing events with my new book, War is a Lie, second edition. I hope to see you. Find the schedule of events at warisalie.org.
Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.